Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. And we're going to spend the rest of the show today with someone who is truly passionate about food and family, Lidia Maticchio-Bastianich. You probably know Lidia as host of the long-running PBS show Lidia's Kitchen. She's the best-selling author of numerous cookbooks, an award-winning chef and owner of four restaurants in New York City, co-founder of Eataly Marketplace here in Boston and in other cities around the world. She also runs a TV production company and sells her own brand of pasta and sauces, even wine. What you may not know is that long before her huge success as a chef and entrepreneur, she was a refugee from communist Yugoslavia, then a young immigrant who came to America with her family in 1958, virtually penniless. Now she has a new memoir that tells that story, My American Dream, A Life of Love, Family, and Food, and she's with me now in the studio. And Lidia Bastianich, it's so great to welcome you to Radio Boston.
Oh, my pleasure. Buongiorno, Antonio.
Buongiorno. Buongiorno. Piacere tutto mio. Ah. Lidia, I want to talk about this childhood behind the Iron Curtain in Istria, right? Mm. So you lived in a city named Pola in what is now Croatia. So I want to ask you about that time in your life and in this particular way. Every stage of your life, food is so central. It seemed to define where you were, mm-hmm. right? So tell us about your early relationship with food in this part of Europe.
Well, Antonio, you know, we were ethnically Italian, yeah. and after the war, that part, Istria and part of Dalmatia, by the Paris Treaty, was given to the newly formed Yugoslavian government, communist Yugoslavia. And we got caught behind it. I was just born about that time. And from sort of the freedom of speaking your own language and practicing your religion, everything was taken away. Mm. And, you know, the communist dogma set in and we had to follow. My mother was an elementary school teacher, so she was being watched. My father had, you know, comfortable business, two little trucks. They were taken away. He was deemed a capitalist, imprisoned for a while. And so things really got kind of tight and rough where we couldn't.
And he was deemed a capitalist because what? He drove a couple of trucks.
Because he had people working for him and yeah. supposedly abusing people, yeah. whatever they consider that. And so my mother, being a teacher, you know, was really watched in the city. She decided to put my brother and myself about 5 kilometers away, a small town called Bursolaire, mm-hmm. where her mother and father lived on a farm. And, you know, things got kind of, food was scarce at that point. And my grandmother would have all the animals and grow and raise all the food to feed the whole family. So I in a sense, lived this free, idyllic life of a child in nature. Mm. We had chickens, we had ducks, we had goats. Every morning for breakfast, I would go with my little can up to grandma. We would milk the goat. We would have breakfast, feed the pigs, you know, in November, the slaughter, and we made prosciutto and sausages. Grandpa made the olive oil, the wine. So everything was done in the house. And I was a little runner. I would bring grandpa what he needed, grandma what she needed. But in the meantime, I was absorbing it. I think I was tasting, you know, taking the nice oil coming down, the torchio. I would just dunk my bread and all those flavors. I mean, I would help grandma harvest the vegetables, you know. So I was very much in tune with the seasons, you know.
Now and the food. I would love it. You write beautifully about your Nonna Rosa and growing up and doing this work in the courtyard. And I'd love it if you could read a brief passage to us. It's from early in your memoir. And you tell the story of the entire family participating in the slaughter of a pig. And the reading picks up right after the butchers have pierced the pig's heart and he has started to die. And then pick up that reading.
The squealing ended. And slowly the pig's movements would ease and then stop. Next, the men turned the pig on its side with the cut towards Grandma and her bucket so she could collect every drop of the pig's blood. While the blood was still warm, Grandma would put it in a large pot on top of the wood-burning stove. She used a long wooden paddle to stir the mixture while it slowly came to a boil. She'd add cornmeal, that is polenta, raisins, cinnamon, salt, pepper, rice, lemon rind, sugar, chopped nuts, and small pieces of chocolate if she had any. Nonna would continue to cook the mixture until it was fairly dense, like porridge, and the rice was cooked. She would then cover it and let it rest in a warm place. In the meantime, The men were shaving and washing the pig with the hot water while it was still up on the plank. When the pig was clean and shaven, the breaking down process began.
I love this passage. And then you go on to talk about the breaking down process, and every piece of the pig, the legs turn into prosciutto, cheeks into guanciale, the tongue all the way to the ears, the hoofs. Everything was consumed and used, right?
Oh, it was so wonderful. Yeah. You know, and that remained with me. You know, nothing was wasted. This great respect for the animals that ultimately, you know, became our sustenance. Everything for the plants, for grandma respected everything. And I think that, you know, maybe this connection to the basics of food growing and all that is not as available as certainly when I was. And it was such a great lesson for me. It really built the base for my food understanding and appreciating and then cooking it.
Yeah. Well, it's a wonderful passage. So this idyllic childhood in Boussoleil and Pola, eventually you get out and you get to essentially a refugee camp in Trieste, right?
Yes. Well, you see, we had family on the other side in Trieste. And so my mother, supposedly her aunt, great aunt in Trieste, was very ill, and we had to go and visit her. So they gave a visa to my brother, my mother, and I, not to my father. My father remained as a hostage because if they let the whole family out, they knew that the families wouldn't return. And so we went to visit this aunt, which seemed perfectly fine once I got there. You know, we were happy in the city. We were free as children. But then one night, about 2 weeks into it, my father joined us, and he had just escaped the border. Escaped at night, you know, they chased him.
It's an amazing story that you tell. I mean, he's literally on foot running for his life.
He is. And you know, when he came, Anthony, he came, I remember, was in the middle of the night. He was all caked with mud. And what later he told me the story that the scent dogs were following him, and he saw a puddle of water and mud, and he rolled himself in that puddle to lose the scent. And by the time he came down another 20 kilometers by foot, he was all caked with the mud when he was on that door. And you just can't forget these things.
Yeah. I mean, it must have been a huge relief to see him arrive.
Oh, my goodness. Everybody was crying, laughing, whatever, you know, smiling. But, you know, the one thing that became evident to me after a few days was that we were all here, and I'm not going back to that idyllic place with Grandma. And I hadn't said goodbye to Grandma or to my friends or to my animals. And I think that that was the point where food really became part of my life, because I used the cooking and the smells of food, like I remember with Grandma, to recall Grandma with me, to bring her with me. And I would cook all the foods that she would cook.
That's such a wonderful description of the power and the importance of food. And you write, again, you write beautifully here. You write that food is unfinished business. And then you write, I had not been given the opportunity to say goodbye, not to my grandparents, not to the farm animals, not to my friends, and not to the lifestyle left behind. Somehow food could bring me back there.
It did.
I almost can't stop. I tear up reading that. It's so pretty.
I'm sure you have that kind of a recall where you're in a place and you smell or you taste that taste and it brings you right back to that place. And so for me, it was, you know, a connection. Connection to that place, and it was with food. And for the rest of my life, I continue connecting with food.
Well, tell me a little bit about, so you end up in a refugee camp in Trieste. Was it a shock for you to be in a place without the comforts of food and, or at least the comforts of your old home?
Absolutely. Once we decided, my parents decided, you know, that they had to kind of go on with their plan. They went to the police station. My father had no papers, so had he been caught, he would have been repatriated. So we went to the police. They sort of registered us and put us in a camp. They said, you have no papers. You need to go in a camp as a refugee. And they put us in San Saba, was a camp in Trieste. Now it's a museum. But before that, it was a Nazi concentration camp. So it was when finally they brought us with this police van to the doors of this camp, and it was this huge gate. And it was kind of, we went in, it was dark. There was this long kind of open hallway, if you will. But once inside, it was kind of humid and it smelled wet and dark and sad. And people kind of huddled, parading. It was very sad, especially being a child of 10 years old. I was afraid. The only comfort is the trust that we had, that I had in my mother and my father, says, they must know what they're doing. We'll be okay. You know, wow. This kind of trust that, and the parents continue to say, oh, we'll be fine. You know, we need to do this. So there was periods, and that's where sort of the dark period, if you will, begins in our lives, where detached from everybody, from all the kind of connections, mm-hmm. nature, family, and you're with stranger, and you are a complete stranger, and you're isolated, and you don't know what the future is going to bring, and you don't know if you'll ever have a home. You don't know if you'll ever see your grandma. It in the child's mind, you know, yes, the unit of the family. So I needed my parents always close because sure. I wanted to be sure.
And yet in that time, you end up going to a convent school, right? And once again, sort of food kind of brings you yeah. back to it sort was, of your heart, I guess. Yeah.
Yes. So, you know, my mother being an elementary school teacher, once they kind of vetted us that we're okay, that we're not espionage or anything, you know, because there was all kind of works there, they allowed my mother to go out and do some houseworks and then come back. You had to be checked out and checked in. So there was a woman that she had an autistic child, and my mother being a teacher, she asked if she would come to their house on a daily basis and teach this child on one-to-one. And in return, she financed my schooling in the nuns' convent. Mm. And we would go together because her house was next to the convent, and we would come together to the camp back at night. But in that convent, yes, for the first time, kind of, I was free again. Also, the nuns, you know, we were forbidden to practice our religion. So they brought me back into the religion. So I began to feel very spiritual, very, very wanted. And in order, I guess, to help a little bit supplement my tuition, they put me in the kitchen in the morning early when I would come, and in sometimes between lunch and in the afternoon. And there I didn't do much. I did what I did for grandma, peel the potatoes, the apples and whatever. But it was my first exposure to big pots and commercial uh-huh. cooking uh-huh. and these nuns in their habits, mind you. Eh?
Yeah.
And they would they had this cuffs, white cuffs. They were called manicotti on top of from their elbow to their wrist to cover their habit. And with this white manicottis, like conductors in the kitchen, they would mix these big pots. And it made me feel good, kind of being, okay, I was again useful with food and with somebody that cared.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a wonderful story. So then go forward a few years, your parents and your sibling, you and your sibling, your brother come to America. You were 12 at the time, right?
Yes.
This is 1958. So what was that like? What did you expect? What did it mean to be imagining life in America at that time?
Well, you know, in the camp, there were options. And we, you know, our first choice was America. Then there was Canada. And then there was Australia. So, you know, you kind of thought about these countries. And we would talk about, the parents would talk about it. You would see pictures and photographs. And so, you know, you had this vision of this big buildings in a beautiful city, bustling. We were brought here because we had nobody in America. In 1958, Dwight Eisenhower was the president, and he opened the immigration for people fleeing communism, mm-hmm. refugee fleeing communism. And we were in the first line. But we were brought here by the Catholic Relief Services, Catholic Charities, and the Red Cross. We had nobody here. So I remember they brought us to JFK. They took us with this yellow school buses into the city, and they put us in a hotel for about 2 weeks until they would settle us. And there we would have to go to the social worker who would kind of give us direction. You know, they were Italian, spoke Italian, and gave my mother a little bit of money so we would feed the children, and we would go around the corner. There was a deli and there was the Big Horn and Harder. That's where we had our first kind of big meal. For us, it was a feast. We never went out to eat, so it was like going out.
Yeah.
And we loved, my brother and I, you know what we really, first of all, the first time I tasted Jell-O was there, the first time I tasted, you know, that was unique, this shaking kind of.
Yeah.
And we loved those, they had those little windows. Did you ever go to a...
The automats.
The right? automat.
Yeah,
the harder and harder.
Years ago, I remember
a
those.
A nickel you put in, you opened the door and you pulled out the cake.
Yeah.
And this was magic for us.
Yeah.
And then we would stay there with the door open, waiting for somebody, the hand to come in and to put another piece of cake. But they never, but usually they never came until we closed the door. So, you know, that's our life. And then ultimately they did find a little home for us in New Jersey, a job for my father, a mechanic job to put radios in Chevrolet cars. I remember.
I want to ask you about your sort of first experience with Italian-American food, right? It all has to come back to food.
Yeah.
But I mean, what was that like for you? Because you write that your first experience of spaghetti and meatballs, veal parmesan, American-style pizza in New York, it's different than what you were eating.
It's completely different. Yeah. It was not recognized. It was a facsimile. You know, you yes, tomatoes, yes, pasta, but the pasta was overcooked. It was too saucy. It was everything. Everything was different, you know?
Too much garlic.
Too much garlic, too much oregano. I says, what kind of cuisine? And, you know, then actually when I really got to know the cuisine is that, you know, fast forward, ultimately we moved to Astoria. I met my husband, who was also an immigrant, and he was in the restaurant business. And ultimately we married. He had one son and he wanted to open a restaurant.
Yeah.
So in 1971, we opened our first restaurant. It was a 9-seater. And there, it was Italian-American food. We took on an Italian-American chef because all the menus, you know, you do diligent research.
Right.
And everything was leading to Italian-American, you know, not the food that we were cooking at home.
Mm.
But so I said, I have to learn this. So I became the sous chef to the chef. And for 9 years, I worked with him and really learned the Italian-American cuisine. And I really came to appreciate it, you know, as a valiant cuisine of the early immigrants adopting to a new country where they came with the memories of food, but they didn't have the products to reproduce.
So they worked with what was available.
What was available, and another cuisine came out. Now, the garlic, you said the garlic. One of the few things that was here that was the same as in Italy was the garlic. And so they used plenty of it because that reminded them they brought them back to home. So that's what the Italian-American cuisine is, loaded with garlic.
Yeah. You know, Lydia, I want to ask you, our time is running out, but sort of as a final question, it's such a powerful immigrant story that you tell here. And I'm just wondering how you think about it in the current political context, because we're in a moment where America perhaps is not as open to immigrants as it once was. Italy, too, for that matter. How do you think about that?
Exactly. I can't help but making the parallel, the comparison. And even I wasn't planning to do my memoir so early. I was planning to do it maybe in 5-10 years for my grandchildren. But when I spoke to my editor, he says, Lydia, this is the time. And he's so right. You know, when I see those children in camps hovering in those tents or whatever, I can't help but think of how I felt when I was in the camp myself. And, you know, I wrote this memoir because it is my story, and it's just a real story, and it's a story of a family that was looking for a place to really build their life, for my parents to offer their children a future. And we were given that opportunity, and we were given the chance, and we wholeheartedly took it in our hands and just made the best out of it. And the results are here, you know.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, giving somebody that's in need will pay back.
All right. Well, that's Lydia Maticchio-Bastianet. She's an award-winning chef, TV host, restaurateur, and author. Her new memoir is My American Dream, A Life of Love, Family, and Food. And she'll be at the Brattle Theater tonight for a Harvard Bookstore event in conversation with me. So we're going to continue this conversation. And
Also
tomorrow at Italy in Boston. And Lydia, what a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That's it for today. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.